Good morning.
Good morning.
So we come to the flood. To understand this, we need to go back a bit. And I'll remind you of the beautiful build-up in chapter 1 of Genesis. Their imagined view of the creation of the world. First of all, there's swirling waters. That's not irrelevant to the story of the flood. So there's massive swirling waters and darkness, and then the Spirit of God hovers over the dark and the deep. So what does God do? Creates light so that God can see what he's doing, obviously, in their story form of it. And then having created light, he creates space. And this is terribly relevant to this story. Creates space by creating a firmament, a solid dome that separated the waters above from the waters beneath. The waters beneath welled up in springs and different ways like that. They could see it. And then God separated out the seas, and they went to certain places, and the land appeared. And then in the heavens, God creates the sun and the moon, unnamed for reasons I've already given you in the book, but the great light, which was to warm the earth, and the lesser light, which was to let us know the flow of time and feasts and up to the new moon festivals, etc. And all that's quite wonderful. Then comes the creation of life, birds and reptiles and wild animals and fish in the sea and so on. And that's on hold. There's no blessing yet. Then humankind comes out of that. Adam, which means humanity, comes out of that. And then God blesses the whole of the living world. It's quite wonderful. And then on the last day, blesses the Sabbath, a day of covenant between this created humanity and God. Well, the flood. Many ancient peoples have memories of cataclysmic flooding. One of the countries that doesn't have that memory, of course, is Israel, because they're in the mountains. It's the mountains of Judah and the mountains of Samaria. That's where their group came. The Philistines were along the coast and so on. So floods have got nothing to do with them. Obviously, they've picked up this story from a land which was very prone to floods, and that is Mesopotamia, where you've got the Zagros Mountains, the high mountains. What am I going? Which way? To the east? Got to look at a map and turn myself around to get it. Yes, to the east. And then the north, you've got massive mountains, and even to the west. And so when the spring comes and the snow melts, you get this massive water coming from the Tigris and the Euphrates River, taking it down to the Persian Gulf and then off. So there would have been times of massive flooding in this area, and in their story, which I did a little bit of with you on the first evening, or on the first morning, in their story, flood becomes the means by which God, sadly, because of sin — this is all story — there never existed a bloke called Adam or a woman called Eve, and there never existed a person called Noah. So, for heaven's sake, we're not talking about historical stuff here. We're talking about story to communicate really important truths. Well, unfortunately, because of the sin, Adam and Eve not listening to God and wanting to be like God on their terms, rather than like God because of grace, which God always wanted us to be like God, in God's image and likeness. Because of that sin, which went on to the next generation with Cain and Abel, and then right through to Lamech, the braggart and the pride and the violence, all that stuff. God, we were told in the last bit we did, God got sick of it all and heartbroken by it all. He had this wonderful vision of what creation was going to be, but because of human sin, the whole thing was going right back to the beginning, and God said, well, that's it. I'll cancel out creation. The flood is not a river flooding. This flood is the firmament, that thing that kept the waters above from the waters below, collapsing. We're going back, right back to the beginnings when it's swirling waters and chaos. And that's their image of this. So don't be looking for floods, of course, create the image, the memory of flooding. But in this story, which comes from Mesopotamia, that's where the Jews picked it up from, this is about something bigger than a massive release of water from the melting snows. This is the waters above rejoining the waters below. So you're right back to Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. Darkness, swirling waters, disorder, chaos. Now that would have happened in their story, except that there was one just man in creation. And they give him the word Noah from Naham, which means to comfort and console. There was one just man. So that one person, as they see it, saved creation. Let's read the story. First of all, the Yahwist. There's two traditions here. One is Yahwist and one is the priestly one. And we're going to, you can discern them when you watch them. So the two have come. This is the Yahwist. Yahweh said to Noah, go into the ark, you and your whole household, because I've seen you to be just before me in this generation. Of every clean animal, now this is new, because what we read yesterday was the priestly account and the one you grew up with, where there's two of every creature. Remember that? Well, look at this. Of every clean animal, and by clean animal they mean one that you can offer in sacrifice to God, take seven pairs, male and female, and one pair of every unclean animal, that is those that cannot be offered in sacrifice, because for various reasons certain ones were taboo. It's very difficult to work it all out because it's not very logical. But, you know, cloven hoof and all this kind of thing. And seven pairs of every bird in the heavens. Seven pairs, because birds were all able to be sacrificed, male and female, to keep their kind alive on earth. For in 7 days, that's one of the phases of the moon, that's how they divided their time up. New moon, half moon, full moon, half moon, new moon. So this is in a 7-day period, a phase of the moon, which they all could observe, as we can. In 7 days, I will bring rain upon the earth. And this rain is the rain from above the firmament. For 40 days and 40 nights. I will wipe from the earth every existing thing that I have made. So God is angry, upset, and determined that the whole experiment has failed, so he's going to wipe it all out. Well, not quite all, because there's Noah. Noah did all that Yahweh commanded. Seven, the number, represents the lunar symbol of fullness. 40 represents the symbol of a generation, the journey through trial to the promised land, hence 40 years of travel in the desert, in their story. Something happened, but as it builds up into the story, 40 comes into it again, of course. Hence Moses is up on the mountain seeing God for 40 days and 40 nights. Hence, Jesus goes after the baptism into the desert, struggling for 40 days and 40 nights. It's a symbol word. I'll read to you from Exodus chapter 24. In the eyes of the sons of Israel, the glory of Yahweh seemed like a devouring fire on the mountain top. Moses went right into the cloud. He went up the mountain and stayed there 40 days and 40 nights. The flood begins now, and the parts in red are from the priestly. They're kind of get working together, schools of thought trying to produce this post-exilic document, which we call the Pentateuch. Noah, say the priest, they're very interested in numbers, was 600 years old when the flood waters came upon the earth. So the numbers are still quite massive, 600 years old, meaning... You remember the marriage feast of Cana, how there are six water jars full, which means that the next is the seventh, the perfection, completion, come to its end, goal, flowering of the whole thing. So if he's 600 years old, the next day he begins his 707th centenary. So... its beauty is going to come in perfection and all of that. The Yahwist write, Noah and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives went into the ark to escape the waters of the flood. Of clean animals and of unclean animals, of birds and all that creeps on the earth, two of each, both clean and unclean. You can see where the priestly document and the Yahwist document are. Not that they don't fit. They've got different views on this. I think you know already, but may I just alert you to it? Because in the Yahwist document, when Noah lands on Mount Ararat, he offers sacrifice to God. Well, if there was only two... and he offered them in sacrifice, that's the end of that. So he needs seven so that he can offer sacrifice to God and still have two to do it. But according to the priests, the only real sacrifices that Yahweh was interested in come after the Exodus. And the burning bush, Moses, and Yahweh is revealed as not exactly a name, but a way to call on the mystery called God. So... that's why they've got this verb. But they keep them both there because they decided they could have value. So they're in the text. Of clean animals, say the priests, and of unclean animals, of birds and all that creeps on the earth, two of each, they went into the ark with Noah, male and female, as God had commanded him. And it would be terrible if I developed this, and I promise I won't. But I hope you can see that the problem of reading the text without understanding and taking it all literally as true, well, were there two or were there seven? Do you get it? I mean, you just can't go. You've got to read this like a story. Because it is a story. After 7 days, the waters of the flood came upon the earth. In the 600th year, write the priests, of Noah's life, in the second month, on the 17th day of the month, well, this is very specific, and you've got eyewitness account here, except when you look at that, it's the second month, so 30 days have gone. It's in the 17th day of the second month. So 30 plus 10 is 40. 40 plus 7. Do you think we're into symbolic numbers here again? That day all the fountains of the great primeval deep, for heaven's sake, this is the waters underneath, etc., burst forth and the windows of heaven were open. So in the priestly account, we're dealing with a collapse of the firmament, a reversal of the work of day two. The space needed for life is lost. All outside the temple, the ark, is destroyed. And, says the Yahwist account, rain poured upon the earth. Well, you could have written this yourself. 40 days. 40 nights. The priestly account. On that very day, so this is a story, you're not supposed to muck it up, I'm mucking it up a bit, but when you tell kids stories, which I used to do hundreds of years ago, to great, great, great nieces, I think it's about that many by now, but anyhow, you tell these stories to them. Imagine how the little kids would like it if you started to tell the story of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, and you started and you said, but Snow White doesn't really exist. Seven Dwarfs, well, they weren't really seven. You know, tell the story and enjoy it. And the children, thank God, haven't yet acquired, I mean, we need to acquire it, they haven't acquired that ability to distinguish between imagination and fact. They're just caught in this wonder world, which is a beautiful place. The longer we can stay in it, the better. So they're in this sense of, well, simpler people didn't have all the distinctions we've got between history and drama and epic and saga and all this, and we need them. They're great distinctions to be able to make, but you've got to go back to a more childlike mind. That is, it's all wonder. And they haven't got the distinctions. So on that very day, he's telling the story, and everyone who's listening to this story are all ears and wondering about it. Noah went into the ark with his sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, with his wife and the three wives of his sons. They and the wild animals of every kind, and livestock of every kind, and all that creeps on the earth of every kind. It's quite a boat. You've got a couple of elephants to fit in, and you've got whales to fit in. It's going to be quite a bit of a show. But anyhow, they're all there of every kind, and birds of every kind, every winged creature. This is wonderful. They all went into the ark with Noah two by two. So the two crocodiles were holding hands as they went into the ark. Two by two, of all flesh that had life in them. And those that went in were male and female of all flesh, and they went in as God had commanded them. And the Yahweh said, and Yahweh, isn't this lovely? He shut the door behind them. So he not only knitted nice little things for them to wear, Adam and Eve, out of kindness, but here they're going in to make sure it's secure. Yahweh comes and closes it, which is very thoughtful and a nice story. Now, there's a pretty famous German scholar called Westermann. You can see there's a few pages in this book. I haven't got a copy of it now, though my copy's in the library at Kensington. The flood in the history of religions. This includes, and I've hinted at this already, a comparison with the flood narratives in the Mesopotamian epic, Enuma Elish. Gilgamesh is the name in the story of the Mesopotamia of Noah. It's their equivalent. There's also in the Babylonian Atrahasis epic, which was from 1700 BC, and a Sumerian epic, and Apollodorus and Ovid. So it's all around this. It comes from the east, but the stories are picked up by the Greeks and then the Romans, etc. The Genesis narrative presumes that crime demands punishment, and that violence, left to itself, would destroy creation. And the Genesis account is focusing on salvation, God's part, to make sure that violence doesn't completely destroy the earth. This is in keeping with the central theme of the whole Pentateuch, Genesis, Exodus, Numbers, etc., Leviticus, Deuteronomy. There's a book by someone called D. Klein, it's the theme of the Pentateuch, and he writes, "No matter how drastic human sin becomes, destroying what God had made good and bringing the world to the brink of uncreation, be a European in the First World War, be a Syrian today." So bringing the world to the brink of uncreation, God's grace never fails to deliver us from the consequences of sin. There's a proviso in there, provided one person is open to grace. If we all close off from grace, God doesn't run the world or control the world or determine what's happening in the world. God loves the world. Someone has to receive that love to keep it alive. And there always seems to be saints everywhere, hopefully including in this room. So Noah listened. Even when we respond to a fresh start with the old pattern of sin, that happened when Adam and Eve came together and gave birth to Seth, a new beginning after the Cain disaster. God's commitment to his world stands firm, and sinful human beings experience the favour of God as well as God's righteous judgments. The flood, the Yahwist. The flood continued 40 days over the earth, and the waters increased and lifted up the ark so that it was high above the earth. And the priests, the waters mounted and mounted and increased greatly upon the earth, and the ark floated above the surface of the waters. The waters mounted greatly upon the earth, and all the high mountains under heaven's expanse were covered. All the high mountains. That's a good enough story if you live in Nineveh or Ashur or Babylon, in that area of the two great rivers. That's fine. However, the story has nothing to say about Mount Ararat being covered with water. That's 17,000 feet. What about the Caucasus? 19,000 feet. What about Mount Everest? 30,000 feet. If you take this literally, that the whole earth and all the high mountains of the earth were covered in water, you know enough science, and I know a little bit of science, to know that that's absolutely impossible and never happened. That's not what they're telling us. They're trying to create a picture of complete returning to chaos. Except for the ark. The waters mounted and rose 15 cubits among the mountain tops. All flesh, every human being, all that moved upon the earth perished. Birds, livestock, wild animals, all that swarmed upon the earth, and every human being, every Adam, perished. The Yahwists write, everything that had the breath of life in its nostrils, everything that lived on the dry land, all died. So Yahweh wiped out every existing thing on the face of the earth, man and beast and crawling thing and bird of heaven. All of them were wiped from the face of the earth. Only Noah was left, and what was with him in the ark. And the priests, so they've knitted all this together, two different views of the world, both important, are kept. The priests write, the waters mounted over the earth for 150 days, 5 months. Now the turning point, the priestly document. Then God remembered Noah. Now this remembering isn't quite what we'd use. It doesn't mean he forgot Noah. He got involved in something else and thought, oh my heavens, Noah. No, it's not that he... But remembering means God's grace and attention and love is directed to Noah. So this is the turning point. It comes from God. God remembered Noah and all the wild and domestic animals that were with him in the ark. And God made a wind blow. The wind, the ruach, the spirit hovered over the waters. The wind blow over the earth so that the waters subsided. The fountains of the primeval deep. And the Yahweh said, and the windows of the heavens were closed. The rain from heaven was stopped and the waters receded gradually from the earth. At the end of 150 days, the flood was subsiding. And on the 17th day of the 7th month, the ark came to rest on the mountains of Ararat. The waters continued to recede until the 10th month. And on the first day of the 10th month, the priests love having months, because they're used to setting up systems of getting everyone to come to Mass, or the equivalent. So they've got this all organised, and so they make it very precise. The tops of the mountains became visible. The Yahwist. At the end of 40 days, it's a different symbolic numbers. Noah opened the window that he'd made in the ark, and he sent the raven out, and it flew to and fro until the water on the earth had dried up. Then Noah sent out the dove to see if the waters of the earth had subsided further. But the dove didn't find any place where it could rest the sole of its foot. So it came back to him in the ark, because there was still water over the whole earth. This is quite a lovely story. Noah put out his hand, caught the dove, and brought it back into the ark. Because we need to continue it. A comment. In the Babylonian epic, after his ship lands on Mount Nazir, Gilgamesh, the equivalent in their myth story, Gilgamesh too had three attempts. He sends out a dove first, then a swallow, and finally a raven. Our text starts with the raven. The practice of using birds to gather information was typical of ancient seafaring. And the Yahwist. Noah waited thrice 7 days. Then he sent the dove of the ark out again. And the dove returned to him in the evening, and we all know this image. It had a freshly plucked olive leaf in its beak. So Noah knew that the waters had subsided from the earth. He waited another 7 days and sent the dove out again, and this time it didn't come back. It's found a thing, a nest and whatever. Priest's document. In the 601st year, in the first month, on the first day of the month, So this is the New Year's Day ceremony, cult. The first year of the 7th century of Noah's life. The waters of the earth were dried up. And the Yahwist document, Noah removed the hatch from the ark and he saw that the face of the earth was drying. And on the 27th day of the second month, the earth was completely dry. Now, for the mathematicians among you, if you work this out, that's good. You get a prize at the end. So the flood lasted 12 lunar months plus 10 days in the priestly account. 12 lunar months plus 10 days is a solar year. The authors are in touch with the physics and mathematics and astrology of Babylon and so on. And they're intelligent people and they're learning. It's all new to them because they lived in this backwater just on the mountains of Judah. There's not a lot happening there by way of culture, I wouldn't think. Simple religious culture, but not much else. So they're interested and they've picked this up. And as they write their story, they've got the whole thing lasting a solar month. There are probably liturgical allusions in the numbers as well. The Babylonian calendar is being used because the ancient calendar of Israel has only names for the months. It didn't number them. So where they're numbering the 7th, 2nd, they picked all that up from exile in Babylon. The priestly account. Noah, God said to Noah, go out of the ark, you and your wife and your sons' wives with you, and all the animals that are with you, all flesh of birds, of cattle, of every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth, bring them out with you, that they may breed upon the earth and increase and multiply upon the earth. So Noah and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives went out together. And every animal, every creeping thing and every bird, everything that moves upon the earth, all of them went out of the ark by families. And now something that is not in the priestly document, but is in the Yahwist document and accounts for what we've already done. Noah built an altar to Yahweh. He took clean animals, those who were able to be sacrificed, and birds, and offered whole burnt offerings upon the altar. And Yahweh smelt the sweet odour. So Yahweh's up there enjoying the perfume of the sacrifice. It's very simple and quite lovely. And Yahweh thought, I'm never going to do this again. Never again will I curse the ground because of human beings. Indeed, the inclination of the human heart is evil from youth. But never again will I slay every living thing that I've made. So God's going to live with human sin. Love us out of it if possible, if we'll listen, but he won't ever destroy us again, as the story has it. So this is not a promise. It's a formal abrogation of the decision to destroy. God is portrayed as deciding to live with sinful human beings and not destroy them. And that's our experience of our own lives and the life of the world. And here a lovely bit of poetry, really. As long as the earth lasts, they will never cease seed time and harvest, frost and heat, summer and winter, night and day. Creation, the rhythm is now re-established and will continue forever. There'll never again be a flood in this sense of the flood. Hence, of course, all through the literature, Old Testament and New, the punishment is going to be fire. not flood. They're the two main destructive elements. Well, flood's out now. God will never do that again. But fire remains a possibility of, inverted commas, punishment. The priests write, God blessed Noah. So that's beautiful. And his sons, and said to them, be fruitful and increase and fill the earth. Fear and dread of you shall come over all the animals of the earth. This is different. This is real life now. The pre-flood stuff is kind of not mythical, but like, it's hard to get a right word for it. It's story. This is actually how things really are. Fear and dread of you shall come over all the animals of the earth, and over all the birds under the heaven, and over all that creeps on the earth, and over all fish in the sea. They're given into your hand. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. This is new. You remember back in the early part, it was the grass only, vegetarians. Now there's this real world in which people eat meat. You may choose not to, but people do. So this is incorporated into the text. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. As I've given you the green plants, so I now give you all. Only flesh with its life, its blood, you shall not eat. A command that comes right through the Old Testament scriptures, because blood is seen as the life force. And when they are not allowed to eat anything strangled, so that the blood is still in the animal. They've got to pour the blood out into the earth and all of that. That's their custom. This is expressive of the tension experienced in the relationship of mankind with other animals. Humans can take life for food, but we must respect the divine blessing given to all living things. So it puts a limit on what we can do. Restraint on bloodlust or killing for the sake of killing is provided by the demand that the God-given, life-giving blood, the dam in Hebrew, must not be eaten by Adam. Adam can't eat dam. And the priests write, for your lifeblood I shall demand satisfaction. From every animal I shall require it. And from human beings I shall require for the death of their fellow human beings. Whoever sheds the blood of a human being, by a human being shall his blood be shed. For God made human beings in the image of God. But you, Noah, etc., be fruitful and increase and spread over the earth and rule over it. So you can already see in this ancient story an attempt to kind of get some control over Cain and Abel and the behaviour that went on then. Humans have the responsibility to care for and provide for and protect other living things. We forfeit our right to live if we take human life. Doesn't Jesus say, he who lives by the sword will die by the sword? Those we see as outsiders are also made in God's image. And the priests continue, God said to Noah and to his sons with him, as for me, I am upholding my promise to you and to your descendants after you, and to every living being that is with you, to the birds, to the livestock, and to all living things with you, to all that have come out of the ark with you. I am upholding my promise to you. It's often translated covenant. The difficulty with the word covenant is, in its use in ancient world, it's kind of something between equals. It's a covenant between two kings or two whatever rulers. In God's case, it doesn't quite fit. In God's case, it's a promise, a commitment that God makes. We're covenanted into that and are free to respond or not. So I'm translating it as many do. It's the word berit in Hebrew as promise or commitment. I am upholding my promise to you that never again shall all flesh be wiped out by the waters of the flood, and that never again shall a flood come to destroy the earth. And God said, another beautiful little part of the story, this is the sign of the promise that I'm making to you and every living being that is with you for all future generations. My bow I am putting in the clouds, which shall be the sign of the promise I'm making to the earth. When I form clouds over the earth, and people think, oh, another flood might be coming. No, that's all right. When I form clouds over the earth and the bow becomes visible in the clouds, I will remember my promise to you. And you and all living beings, and never again will the waters become a flood so as to destroy all flesh. And when the bow is there in the clouds, I, promises God, I look at it so as to remember the everlasting promise made by God to all living beings, all flesh on the earth. And God said to Noah, this is the sign of the promise that I will uphold between myself and all flesh that is on the earth. So by way of a brief comment, the covenant with Noah is for the whole human race. It forbids violence, which was the main cause of the condition that almost brought about the return to chaos. It stands forever and is not abrogated by the later covenant made with Abraham, which was for the special people for a special mission. This later covenant does not involve rejection of those nor not chosen for this mission. So we're going to do starting, well, tomorrow in fact, we're going to start the wonderful story of the patriarchs, which is totally different literature from these first 11 chapters. And when we do that, that's all very special, and it's for a special people, for a special mission. But over and above all that is the promise God makes to humanity, to all, everyone, of every culture and every race. I think this is quite beautiful, so I'll share it with you. A modern Italian Jewish scholar, Cassuto, captures the essential symbolic significance of the narrative of the flood in his commentary on the book of Genesis. And he writes, it depicts for us, step by step, the acts of divine justice that bring destruction upon the earth, which has become filled with violence. And the scenes which pass before us grow increasingly gloomier until in the darkness of death there remains only one tiny, faint point of light, namely the ark, which floats on the fearful waters that have covered everything and which guards within its walls the hope of a future life. And he continues, we then see consecutively the various stages of the divine compassion that renews life upon the earth. The light that waned until it becomes a minute point in the midst of the dark world begins to grow bigger and brighter, till it illumines again the entire scene before us, and shows us a calm and peaceful world crowned with its colours, a sign and pledge of life and peace from the coming generations. So if I was going to leave you with one image of this flood, it's the image that the ark is actually a temple. So you've got the swirling waters of our world, still, the swirling destructive violence that produces chaos, that can all be happening. But in this story, there's a temple, a sacred place. And in that sacred place is all life that we need for the development of the world, and all love and all truth and all covenant and all promise. And out of that temple comes forth the light, the life, which will always be there because of God's commitment. The ambiguity of the human condition is that humanity is good and evil. The heart is good and evil. Filial impiety and piety. And we're going to look at that now in the story from the Yahwist, still in chapter 9 of Genesis. The sons of Noah. So we've got a new start and we're hoping everything will be totally beautiful. But the sons of Noah who went out of the ark were Shem, Ham and Japheth. Ham was the father of Canaan. That's the Palestine. These three were the sons of Noah, and the whole earth was populated from them. Noah, as the first man of the soil, planted a vineyard. He drank from the wine and became drunk and lay naked in his tent. I don't know what to make of this story, but here it is. And when Ham, the father of Canaan, saw his father's nakedness, he went outside and told his two brothers, "Come and look at Dad." But Shem and Japheth, very modestly, took a cloak and put it on the shoulders of each of them, walked backwards and covered the father's nakedness. Their faces were turned away, and so they didn't see their father's nakedness. And when Noah awoke from the effects of the wine and knew what his youngest son had done to him, he said, and this fits the Jewish idea, of course, "Cursed be Canaan." Well, they must have done something bad, because God, according to their story, which is not history at all, under Joshua, they destroyed all the Canaanites, and God told them to get rid of a lot of them. They'd been cursed right back at the beginning. "Slave of slave shall he be to his brothers." And he said, "Blessed be Yahweh, the God of Shem, but Canaan shall be his slave. May Yahweh enlarge Japheth," enlarge Yapt, you can see the in Hebrew the pun on words, "that he may dwell in the tents of Shem, and let Canaan be his slave." So what are we learning here? Evil is still at work after the flood. We're learning that the benefits of civilization are traced to a human being, Noah, not to the gods, as in the ancient myths. We've learnt that the fruits of the soil are ambivalent. They're good, they're meant to refresh, but they can also cause problems. In the world of human experience, the forces of evil cannot completely dominate. And we've learned that our friendship with the soil, with our Father, and with God affect all our relationships. Father-son relationship is critical for the realization of the divine blessing. And please remember what I said yesterday. As they understood it, the male was the sole source of life. The female's role was to accept the seed, which of course is not a seed, but they didn't know that, accept the seed and nurture it and bring it up and all that. And hence, in some cultures still, it's amazing how long we take to let science infuse into our theology. There are still some cultures where the firstborn boy is such a joy to parents. And they don't know that the reason why it is such a joy is that they've been thinking for centuries that the boy will hand on life from the family. The girl doesn't. She receives life from her husband. Do you see the problem with the false biology leading to a lot of stuff that's still affecting us? Justification for Semites having Canaanites as slaves is in this text. So there's ideology helping to form this post-exilic community. Genesis 9. Noah lived another 350 years after the flood, and all the days of Noah were 950 years. And he died. So we've actually completed the bulk of the saga, the story, the primeval story, nothing to do with history. A story to communicate certain values and what they thought were values, but weren't. So it's part of their culture. They're doing their best to hold it together. After now, in the next one this morning, I'm going to take you to their understanding of geography and how all the nations of the world develop. It's not, well, I don't find it immensely inspiring, but it's there, so I want to do it with you. And then tomorrow morning we'll look at the Tower of Babel, and then that'll free us up to get into the far more significant literature of Genesis, which starts with Abraham in chapter 12. I'll conclude now by a piece of music. Create in us a clean heart. So we're told, and we know it's true, that there's ambivalence going on in our heart, in our relationships, in our culture. It's not all evil by any means. It's basically good, but there are problems in it still.